Building Blocks of Resilience. Globalization in our world has changed the way we live, the way we work, the way we think, and the way we solve our problems. It's even changed the kind of problems that need to be solved. Judith Rodin encapsulates precisely why we need to think differently when it comes to our communities and our cities today. She says, quote, "What distinguishes today's threats from those of the past are the escalating rate at which they are occurring and the growing interconnectedness of our planet. Building resilience is not a luxury, it's a 21st century imperative," she says, end of quote. I agree with what Rodin is saying. Resilience is a 21st century imperative. Now the obvious question is how? How do we go from creating personal resilience, as described in the last chapter, to building resilient families and forming resilient communities? Maybe an even bigger question is how do we do so in the face of already established systems that people have come to accept as the standard and the way things are done? The study of resilient lifestyles and communities is a relatively recent area of research. Some of the first studies to use the word resilience itself were published only in the early 1970s, referencing human illness. For example, who gets sick, who doesn't, and how quickly do those who do get sick recover from their sickness? I've had the opportunity to study many of the findings from the research of other people. I've also witnessed resilience personally in the rural communities of northern New Mexico when conditions of nature and broken economies have created tremendous hardship where I live. I can honestly say that in all of the many facets of resilience, I've yet to find a single theory or one method that holds all of the answers that seem to be necessary. Just as there are different kinds of communities that meet the needs of different populations, there are different kinds of resilience and a variety of ways to get to that resilience. At the end of this audiobook, I'll share some of the resources describing case histories and real-world experiments in creating community resilience. I'd like to begin here, however, with the broad factors that apply to any kind of resilience, whether it's a single family or a neighborhood or a digital community that extends worldwide. One of the best summaries of these factors stems from the expertise of hundreds of scientists and researchers contributing to the resilient studies mentioned previously. Researchers at the Rockefeller Foundation identify 5 key elements of resilience that are general enough to cover nearly any community situation, yet specific enough to give us a place to begin. These core principles of resilience are identified as 1, spare capacity, creating a cushion beyond what is only needed in the moment. 2, flexibility, the ability to change, evolve, and adapt in the face of disaster. 3, limited or safe failure, which prevents failures in one place from rippling across entire systems. 4, rapid rebound, the capacity to reestablish function and avoid long-term disruptions. 5, constant learning, the robust feedback loops that tell us what works and what doesn't. When we consider the turning points identified in Chapter 3 and the principles of personal resilience described in Chapter 4, we find that the general theme of these 5 principles provides an umbrella under which we can adapt and customize according to our personal and community resilience needs. So let's take a closer look at each of these 5 keys and see how it fits into the turning points within our own communities. Spare capacity. There's a big difference between having our needs in the moment met easily and thoughtfully planning ahead, so the same can be true for the future. There's also a powerful difference between planning responsibly for the realities of life and hoarding frantically at the last minute to compensate for a lack of planning. When it comes to our time of extremes, we're witnessing both of these scenarios. I've met people who believe that we're heading toward a world that reflects the worst-case scenarios portrayed by Hollywood movies and cable television documentaries. These are frightening images that remind me of the 1979 movie Mad Max, showing a post-apocalyptic world after climate change, war, and after the end of oil. I've also known people at the opposite end of the spectrum who have found the seemingly endless supply of fresh fruits and vegetables and household products at their neighborhood market are so reliable that they believe these things will always be this way and count on an immediate and ever-constant supply of food and produce for each and every meal. They become so accustomed to finding what they need on demand that they feel there's simply no reason to plan any further ahead than the day that the meal is needed. Clearly, I like the idea of eating the freshest fruits and vegetables when possible, and enjoy daily trips to the market myself when I can. The concern here is the issue of what happens if the supply isn't available. How long can these people, or any of us for that matter, care for and nourish ourselves and our families with what we have today, right now in our kitchen cabinets? As creatures of habit, we tend to reflect the way we've lived life at a particular time in our past. Once a habit is in place, we often give the idea of changing it very little thought. This is where the resilient principle of spare capacity comes in. In our time of extremes, we're finding that things simply don't work as reliably as they may have in the past. What was once the rare interruption of basic services, such as electricity and full grocery shelves, for example, is becoming commonplace. The reasons range from freak storms, high winds, and deep snow to the economic realities of downsized workforces, shorter work weeks, and fewer stocks of available goods. Following are some examples of precisely such interruptions. Example number one, electricity in the United States is becoming less reliable, following a trend that began 15 years ago. A study published by Masoud Amin, director of the Technical Leadership Institute at the University of Minnesota, states, quote, "Since 1995, electrical grid power outages have steadily increased as R&D, the research and development in new technologies, has steadily decreased," end of quote. Example number two. Among the increasingly apparent effects of extreme weather are temporary disruptions of vital supplies to local markets. Brooklyn, New York, in the winter of 2010, is a perfect example of what I mean here. For nearly a week, supply trucks simply could not get to the grocery stores that needed replenishing. A quote reported by a local media source at the time summed up the city's dilemma. It stated, 3 days. No deliveries. You see, all the shelves are empty, said a store clerk. Example number three. Extreme weather conditions are catching multiple communities and entire regions unprepared. The effects are devastating, and the disruption of services can last from a few days to as long as many months. Example number four. 1 month after Hurricane Sandy slammed into the eastern seaboard of the United States, 8.1 million homes in 17 states remained with no electricity. The rationing of gasoline at service stations in New York City lasted for 15 days. Example number five. In February of 2011, as temperatures dropped to a record 36 degrees below zero, a state of emergency was declared in northern New Mexico. The natural gas used to heat the homes and farms was shut off without warning due to the increased demand for power and rolling blackouts. These conditions, though they are rare now, are becoming less so. It's because we're living a time of such extremes that the resilient principle of spare capacity makes more sense now than ever. It makes sense to expect periodic and temporary disruptions in the services that we've taken for granted for so much of our lives. Far from the labels of commando and preppers that have been used to describe people who take such precautions, to create spare capacity is now a reasonable choice that reflects the facts of a changing world. To do so is simply to be responsible. We're surrounded by wonderful models of spare capacity in nature. When the weather is good, and food is plentiful, for example, we see squirrels finding what they need for their daily nutrition. So this is like us going to the neighborhood market every day because we can. We also see the same squirrels taking extra food and putting it away for the proverbial rainy day, the cold months, when they instinctively know that food will become less available. We see something similar with bears and other forms of life that instinctively add to their body weight in the good times to sustain themselves when the times are not so good. This is the equivalent of us creating spare capacity by stocking up on a few of the essentials that we rely upon every day just in case there's a day when we cannot get them. In nature, we don't see these animals in a chaotic and last-minute frenzy fighting tooth and nail out of fear and scarcity. They don't need to, because they've created the spare capacity in their lives that mirrors the reality of their world.